Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway. We've got a great guest today, my friend Jason Falls, who is a marketing social media mogul. And we're going to talk about the way that social media has played a role in the coronavirus situation. It's kind of a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on one hand, we're able to get information out super fast, and we're also able to stay connected despite being social distanced, right? Like, you can still stay connected with your friends. How many people are sharing coronavirus quarantine memes, right? Like me, I'm raising my hand. It's a way to feel like we're still all part of the same party while at the same time being physically distant from each other. So it's that side of it is very good. The other side of it is that, as it has always done, it is spreading anger and divisiveness, false information, etc. So we're going to talk about that. I got a couple things I wanted to go over with you, though. I just posted a series of tweets about reopening the country for business. And I'll just kind of go through these because, you know, the president is getting ready. He said he has a goal of April 15th, which is Easter. I don't know if that's realistic or not, but the president does things this way. He puts out a goal, and then if we don't quite get to it, then, you know, maybe within a week or so of that, which is all great. But the idea that he is talking about getting us back to work, I think, is very positive, and it's what I've been calling for some time. In fact, I think in Kentucky, well, Councilman Anthony Piacentini, who's been on with me a couple of times, has sent a letter to the governor saying, let's put together a task force on how we get the economy out of the hole once we get through this whole social distancing part. But maybe a more realistic goal for actually opening up the country is, like, say, May 1st, right? Because there's two benchmarks that need to be reached before we can actually open the country back up. And I think when we do open the country back up, it needs to be in an incremental way. So let me explain what I think that should be like. First, we need to have the ability to test anybody. And regardless of what the president said at the beginning of this, we do not have the ability to test anybody. But we are going to have it. New tests have been approved that we'll be able to give you results in a couple of hours. Here's how I would like to see that work. Once we get in enough tests that everybody can have multiples, then we say to businesses, if you want to reopen, here's the stipulation. You've got to test your employees once a week. And then once you reopen, show us your plan for how you're going to keep people 6 feet apart. I was at Whole Foods the other day, and they have tape lines and signs that tell people where to stand roughly 6 feet apart from each other. They've put plexiglass panels between where you would talk to the cashier and their face. So they're doing some things that are... And other grocery stores are doing this in different ways, but they're mitigating our closeness. So show your plan for that. Like, if you're a restaurant, don't sit booths back to back initially. Just skip a booth or skip a table. Show us your plan and test your employees weekly. That's one benchmark. Once everybody can get tested, employers should test their employees weekly for the next 6 months or so. The second benchmark, and this one's more important, is hospital capacity. The reason we don't shut America down every year for the flu is because we have prepared for it. We can't kill the flu. We have vaccines, which mitigates it somewhat. We have some level of herd immunity, which mitigates it somewhat. We have therapeutics, which mitigates it somewhat for most people. But we still know that a number of people, for instance, 41,000 people have died since October from the flu this year. And we know that that's about what this is a little bit rougher flu season than most, but we know that that's roughly where it's going to be. So hospital capacity is prepared for that. In the flu season, they're prepared for that. They have enough PPE, they have enough testing, they have enough beds and respirators for that. Now you add on top of that another virus that's about the same or even worse than the flu, and you're doubling what you need, right? So it's going to take us a little while to get up to where we need, but that should be the focus. Once we get our capacity in hospitals up, enough respirators, enough beds, which I think should take 2 to 4 weeks, once that's up, then we need to start thinking about saving the economy to save lives, right? Because I don't want anybody to die, and I want to make that very clear. Someone called me the D word for male genitalia on Twitter yesterday because she said that I was choosing economic life over virus life being taken. And I was like, I responded and I was like, what's the difference? If a life is taken because the economy collapsed and a life is taken from the virus collapse, why is one more moral than the other? Like that way of thinking just doesn't compute with me. I didn't quite understand what was going on in that person's brain, but then that's Twitter for you. But the point I'm making is I want to save lives. And I can tell you right now that if we remain shut indefinitely, this economy collapses and the world's with it, and it will, the economic devastation that comes from that will kill far more people than this virus ever thought to. I believe that we should fight both at the same time. We should fight for our economy and we should fight the disease at the same time. In fact, I believe that it is irresponsible not to fight both at the same time. We are America. We fought World War II on two fronts. On two fronts. And since then, militarily, our military strategy has been to be able to wage war on two fronts. Well, that changed about 10, 15 years ago under Donald Rumsfeld when we decided we wanted to do more surgical. But the idea, you get it. Two fronts. So we ought to be able to wage war on two fronts. Let's open the economy back up and fight the disease. So here's how it ought to work. Once capacity is reached in the hospital so we can handle about double what we get from the flu, once we have testing available, and testing will tell us a lot too. I mean, not to totally go by the side here, but testing will tell us a lot because I think, and I just saw an article this morning, that there's probably way more people with coronavirus in their system than we even know about. There was an article yesterday, the UK, maybe half the population is infected. But that's actually good news because that means that the vast majority of people don't experience any symptoms at all, or if they do, it's like the sniffles. Now, why is that a good thing? It means that herd immunity is being able to be developed. So there's that whole thing going on. So once we got testing in place, we can tell who's got it and who's really experiencing symptoms, and we'll know even better at that point who's really vulnerable. But once we get testing in place, that's benchmark number one, and we can start to slowly reopen. Benchmark number two is that we have capacity. And when we have capacity, then we can start to say, all right, let's let younger, healthier people go back to work. Let's do this in phases. We won't necessarily have concerts yet. We won't necessarily have huge gatherings of people yet. We won't necessarily have big events yet, right? But we're going to open up restaurants where people aren't sat side by side. We're going to open up retail stores so people can go back and buy clothes and cut their hair, opening up salons and those kinds of businesses, right? And we'll do that for about 3 months, and we'll keep elderly and the immune compromised still separated and say, guys, don't go out if you can help it. Stay put. We'll send somebody to send you your food. And then after that, once we've gotten to the other side of that bell curve, we can start to let those people back out. And then by next year, we're prepared with more beds. Because let me just say this, and this is an awful truth that is going to sound terrible, but the truth of the matter is most likely we cannot defeat this virus. All the viruses that we have had in the past, almost all of them have stuck around. There's only, in my opinion, I think polio is the only one we've ever cured. I think every other virus still exists in some form. What we've got is herd immunity. What we've got is inoculations. And we should work towards that goal. But the virus won't ever be dead. What we have to do is have the capacity to handle what it does to human society. We can save the most lives by having the most beds and the most respirators. We know, doctors will tell you this, we know that a certain number of thousands of people will die in America every year to the flu. We also know about who those people are in the sense that we know what segment of the population they're going to come from. We're going to know the same thing about this virus. And once hospital capacity is up to be able to handle that, we have to let healthy people go back to work because otherwise we're going to kill more people than the virus will. How are we going to do that? Because we're going to lose the rule of law. Desperation and poverty will set in. Violence will erupt and people will die. More people than this virus can kill. So it's vital that we get back to work. But I think it needs to be done in a staged and planned way. And what bothers me is what I'm seeing now is the same thing I see all the time in politics in America today. It's one way or the other. It's your side, my side. I'm not talking about this as a Republican. I'm an independent. I'm not even a Republican. And I don't think President Trump has handled this entirely well. I think he's doing some of the right things now, but I think in the beginning he denied this was a problem. And so did I, because most of us didn't have the information. I don't necessarily blame him for that. Sip of coffee. What I do say is that what I see is the president says we're going to open on April 15th, and the whole country, all the media and the left goes, we can open, they're going to kill people. No, there's a middle ground here, right? We may not be ready by the 15th, and we should say that. We may not be ready till May 1st, but you have to give people and businesses some sense that they're going to be through this and they can reopen their business. And you can. That's why I'm talking about benchmarks. Look, we think we'll be at benchmark number one in 2 weeks. We think we'll be at benchmark number two in 3 weeks. Okay, if we're not there, guys, we got to wait another week to open up, okay? We're almost there. But at least you're giving people that goal. And Americans will be far more likely to stay put in their homes during that period of time if there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't mean just saying there's a light at the end of the tunnel, a specific structural plan for how we're going to work that out. That's what I don't think Governor Beshear has started thinking about yet. Although I hope this letter from Councilman Anthony Piacentini brings that up. And I don't even know that the president is thinking along those lines. The president is feeling pressure from his base to reopen. I'm not sure he's thinking through how we're going to reopen. We need both epidemiologists, doctors, scientists, and business people sitting at a table advising the president, not one or the other. And early on, it seemed like it was just the business people. Now it seems like it's just the doctors and scientists. There needs to be both. There needs to be an understanding of what is the path of this virus, but also how can we avoid that path while staying open for business. I think this is vital. All right, let's talk about something really interesting, social media. And we're also going to talk about this with our guest today, because I just came across this article. Your smartphone might be ratting on you for not social distancing. I find this fascinating. Hotair.com has the article. Boy, this is good coffee. Sorry, it's really good coffee. So there was an article from the Washington Post that they pulled an excerpt out of. Here it is. On Tuesday, a company called Unicast that collects and analyzes phone GPS location data launched a social distancing scoreboard that grades county by county which residents are changing behavior at the urging of health officials. So here's what's happening. Your iPhone specifically. iPhone has partnered with a third-party company. Maybe we'll call it a digital guardian angel if you want. And it's partnered with a third-party company that is basically, your phone is tracking how far you are away from other people with similar devices. This is the Orwellian world we live in now. Which, by the way, let me just take a pause here real quick. We're starting to see what it would be like to live in a totalitarian police state. Whether or not this is the right solution, I saw this article yesterday, Indiana State Police are going to help enforce the stay-at-home rule. So they're going to be pulling people over or contacting people and saying, hey, are you, I don't know if they're pulling people over, but they're going to be contacting people just to make sure that the reason they're out of the house is a good reason, right? That papers, please, right? I mean, let's see, why are you, oh, you're going to the grocery store? Are you sure? Oh, you're going for a walk? Okay, are you sure? I'm not saying that's the wrong way to handle this, okay? I'm just saying we're getting a taste of what it would be like to live in a police state. And I hope that Americans don't become used or comfortable to it. Because I feel like a lot of people on the younger end are getting really comfortable with it. That bugs me. So anyway, here's a digital step on this. On Tuesday, a company called Unicast that collects and analyzes phone GPS location data launched a, and just so you know, there are companies out there that are doing that to you right now. Wherever your phone is, they want to know. They're looking at you. What are you doing? What you doing over there, buddy? You don't normally go over there on a Friday. GPS location data launched a social distancing scoreboard that grades county by county which residents are changing behavior at the urging of health officials. It uses the reduction in the total distance we travel as a rough index for whether we're staying put at home. Comparing the nation's mass movements from March 20th to an average Friday, Washington, D.C. gets an A, while Wyoming as a whole earns an F. I can tell you right now, I leave the house every day. Not to go be around people. I go hiking alone in the woods. But that's my sanity right now. But I guess I would get a bad grade for social distancing, right? I'm not coming into contact with anybody. I get in my car, I drive to the trail. Get out of my car, I walk the trail. I run the trail. I climb the trail. I get back to the car. Okay, I stop at a fast food restaurant to get a glass of iced tea, all right? But I don't touch anybody. I don't come into contact with anybody, and I'm never closer than 6 feet. But I guess I get an F. All right, my buddy Jason Falls is with us now. He is the author of several books on social media marketing. I call him a social media marketing guru. He also works in the advertising industry and has been really, I think, crucial in some campaigns that you've probably seen around the state of Kentucky with regards to bourbon and other things. What's going on, Jason? Welcome to the Disruption Zone. How are you? It's good to have you back.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, Leland. There's I think we're all sort of feeling our own disruption zones of late, but it's good to be on the show.
Yeah, you know, you and I are about the same generation, Gen X, I think, and we've known each other for a long time. Can you imagine, could you have ever imagined something like this happening? I mean, we grew up in a world where my grandparents collected tinfoil for the World War II effort. You know, we have, it's a hilarious joke in our home. My grandfather had, Papaw had an RC Cola bottle that he never got rid of the bottle. He had one of those plastic caps that you could put over it to seal it, and he put Czech Cola in it from Winn-Dixie. He just refilled the bottle. He couldn't throw it away because, you know. So our grandparents sort of had that mentality. We had no idea what facing a challenge like this is like.
Yeah, I don't think that I could have ever imagined it when I was growing up. I mean, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing such a weird, you know, reaction to the, I guess, inconveniences and or sacrifices from different generations. What I will say, though, is I think that our generation, Generation X, has at least a one or two generation, you know, connection to, you know, some of our parents had to, you know, serve in Vietnam. Our grandparents certainly had to go through World War II. So we grew up in a world knowing that things could get bad, but it was right. Kind of a mind's eye kind of thing. It wasn't really something that we had to deal with ourselves. The thing that I am seeing from the, you know, Gen Z and the Alpha generation and all of the, you know, teenagers and 20, 30 somethings these days, what I am seeing is they have grown up their entire lives living in a world where everything is free and easy and entitled, and they can kind of really have everything they want. And they've never really had to sacrifice a whole lot.
Right.
I mean, 9/11 was a shock, but we as a country and as a world kind of recovered from that pretty quickly.
Right.
I don't think they even have a mind's eye imagination of what it's like to have to, you know, like in Great Britain, ration during the war and things like that. They don't have a concept that that's what you have to do. So I think that's why we're seeing a bunch of different reactions.
I think that's interesting. And part of what you do as a social media guru is study generational reaction to things, because you have to know what connects with different groups. And I think it's interesting, and maybe you've seen this too, but it appears to me like the generation, you mentioned Gen X, we appear to be the ones that are kind of taking it, like, to be honest with you, I don't see very many elderly people self-distancing, and I don't see really young people self-distancing. It's kind of like maybe millennials and Gen X, for the first time, we're on the same team, and we're all kind of like side-eyeing this whole thing, like, yeah, we want to get back to business, but let's kind of take this a little bit seriously for the time being, right? You know, it's almost like we're the ones that are like, okay, I'll sit on my couch and watch Netflix for the next 2 weeks, whatever I got to do.
Well, I think this is also something that that is probably more close to the typical topics that you talk about. I honestly think that the younger generation, you have to remember, as they've moved through childhood and into young adulthood, they have also grown up in a world where social media is, you know, ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And they've grown up in a world where there really isn't a trusted source of information.
Yeah, it's a good
point. Because one side of the aisle is always questioning and criticizing the other side of the aisle.
Right.
And that extends beyond Washington and Frankfurt and everywhere else. It extends to the media now, because now you've got media outlets that are blatantly biased one side of the equation or the other.
Right.
And so they don't really have a trusted source of information. And that, therefore, social media, which democratized publishing, also destroyed, you know, good old fashioned ethical journalism, I think,
right,
in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so they're getting their information from sources that may not necessarily be credible or well-researched or well-founded. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I think they don't know who to believe.
Right.
And therefore they're like, this coronavirus thing, I'm not worried about it. It's just going to, it's like the flu, no big deal. And Gen Xers are like, you know what? When the governor and the media and the president and a bunch of other people are saying, yeah, you probably ought to stay home. I think you probably ought to stay home.
Yeah, exactly. Well, plus, we're the generation that saw Outbreak and Dustin Hoffman. We don't want our city to be firebombed by the military.
That's true.
We're willing to watch Netflix for a couple weeks, like I said. So, well, let's dive into the technological side of this, because I'm fascinated. And I've always warned about, you know, privacy and those kinds of things. I see the double-edged sword of the digital sphere. I fully embrace technology. I love technology. I love what it does for us. But I also understand that there's dystopian dangers that come along with it. And the perfect example of it is the iPhone. Apple has partnered with a third-party company called Unicast, and it collects and analyzes data from people's iPhone GPS location information, and they've created a social distancing scoreboard where it's grading county by county which residents are changing their behavior at the urging of health officials. So we now have our phones are spying on us to see. But then there's also a good side of this, right? Like, it's totally creepy. But on the other side of that, the tool that officials can have in making decisions about whether or not certain things are being followed, you know. I see the advantage to this, but it freaks me out at the same time.
Well, I can understand that, and it does seem a little big brothery creepy. But I also look at it, and I am not a conspiracy theorist, and I don't worry too much about the companies that are doing this, because I know that they are anonymizing the data. Right. They're not looking at Jason Falls's iPhone. They're looking at a signal from a device in some person's hand. They don't necessarily connect that tracking to me personally.
Right.
So when you look at the aggregation of that data as one, that's where you can have these really powerful insights to say, hey, here's a new recommended behavior. And the data is showing us from these electronic signals that people are not following the advice. And so that, again, like to your point, that gives our government officials the data that they need to come back and, you know, up the ante on the message and maybe even on some restrictions that have to be in place for people to follow them.
Here's the scary part for me, though, and this is a paragraph taken from the article on it, but monitoring social distancing at a time when government executives are exercising unprecedented authoritarian power all across the country is pretty disturbing. Keep in mind that Unicast isn't just looking at averages or general trends. In order for the data to be useful to their customers, they have to know the specifics of individual users' travel habits for every phone they can tap into. And if that data exists somewhere, it's not beyond the reach of government, particularly at this moment in history. Okay, so to your point, they are anonymizing it, and right now they're anonymizing it, but pretty soon they might not. Remember, we had a guy in, I can't remember which county it was, in Kentucky, that refused his stay-at-home order after being diagnosed with COVID-19. They had to send deputies to his house. Now, in a case like that, we're probably pretty glad we can find that guy and keep him home, because he has it and he's spreading it and he could kill your grandmother. But at the same time, we're just a thin wall away from potential abuse. And that kind of scares me.
It does kind of scare me, too. And I think it scares me more so on the reason that it scares me more than it probably normally would is I worry that there are some elected officials in some offices that would abuse that power.
Right.
With a, you know, a diplomatic, empathetic, caring leadership in place. And I'm not pointing a finger at one person. I'm just saying, in general, if you have someone who's working in the best interests of all citizens and the country, then I think I would trust that someone would not abuse the privilege of having that information. But I worry that there are some people who have been elected to certain offices in this country that would absolutely look at it as an opportunity to punish a certain group of people that's against them and or monetize it in a way that is, you know, a conflict of interest. And that's where my concern comes in. I'm not so worried about the government coming to my house and saying, Jason, you can't go to the grocery store anymore.
Right.
I'm more concerned about the abuses that are going to turn this into something that is far from a democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. We're always, and that's the thing, is we're always one election away from, you know, not realizing we elected a tyrant. And it's like, the more tools, I think history bears out that every tool that's been given into the hands of the government, it is eventually used against its own people in some form or another. So, I mean, I think you bring up a good point. For now, this is probably helping a lot of really good-hearted, you know, leaders in our communities make the right good-hearted decision, and I get that. So, again, here we are back at that same place, the double-edged sword of technology. Question for you, are you, how much, because this would be more like about an economic trend, because the economies fascinate me, right? Like in a lot of ways, what we're doing right now is extremely dangerous for America because of the way our economy is built basically on consumption. But there's also areas of the economy that are these huge bright lights. You know, I talked to a drive-through owner. I know the guy who owns a fast food restaurant in my community, and I just asked him a few days into the statewide shutdown, like, how are you doing? He said, dude, I'm actually on par with my normal numbers because everybody else had to shut down. And so my drive-thru's open and people can come through. He's like, I'm doing great. But he understands that other people are not. I don't know about you, but I've switched to a lot of online stuff. I get my meat from ButcherBox. Shameless plug here for those guys. They're awesome. It comes to my door. I never even have to go to the grocery store for it. I've started ordering a lot of things online. Have you made those changes? Do you think this will be something that is a shift, a fundamental shift in our economy going forward, that a lot of people will go, oh, that online ordering was pretty easy. I think I'll stick with that.
Yeah, I definitely think it's going to have a big impact. I think it already has. It started to, but I think this is going to accelerate that shift. I think, you know, retail businesses are in a lot of trouble. And in trouble more so now than they ever were, because, like, for instance, there's a service that I use, shameless plug, called Every Plate.
Right.
And because I don't cook at home, I'm not a great cook, but I'm a single, you know, divorced dad who has my kids half the time.
Right.
And so I have to provide healthy meals and whatnot. Well, Every Plate sends me three or four meals for the three of us per week for a very reasonable amount of money. Everything except like vegetable oil and salt comes in the package. So I don't have to go to the grocery store. I don't have to worry about buying healthy foods because they're all going to come to me. Right. And that has made my, you know, my retail experience from a grocer's perspective not go away completely, but it's certainly reduced it by about 50% to 60%. And the fact that we can sit in our houses and dial up entertainment and dial up food delivery and dial up prescriptions and other necessities that we would typically have to go into a retail environment for. Now that we're being forced to stay at home and told not to interact with other human beings, I think the gas pedal has just been put down on destroying retail as we know it.
Yeah, I think it'll change. It'll change the modern mall. It'll change the modern shopping experience. I think we'll probably see a shift when we come through this to the other side, back to more of a social gathering type situation where, you know, there's places, not like we're going to go through this whole episode giving out shameless plugs, but let's throw it out there. You know, I like what they've done in Lexington with the Summit. It's more of a social gathering place that has retail around it, right? And that's going to have to probably be the future of any sort of retail area. You've got the food barn where you can go through and you've got all these different choices. It's more of a gathering place. And once we get through this and we feel comfortable gathering again, that's probably more the future than an actual retail store. And I know that I have one particular clothing retailer that I have their credit card or whatever, because I get 20% off when I use it. And they're in panic mode right now. I used to get like one email every 3 or 4 days about a sale or, you know, you have this many points. Now I'm getting 4 or 5 emails a day from them to remind me that I can buy my stuff online. It's like they're panicked. They don't know if they're going to be able to reopen or not.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of businesses that are in that panic mode. Unfortunately, you know, they're also, when they shift into panic mode, they're also shifting into tone deaf mode.
Right.
Because if someone's dealing with either being infected or a family member being infected, they don't give a crap about blue jeans. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, as marketers or, you know, and I work in the advertising business, from day one in this whole thing, which was before the schools shut down and whatnot, we were starting to talk to our clients and help our clients think forward a little bit and say, okay, how can we respond in an empathetic way for your brand, as opposed to just trying to sell crap, because that's going to come across wrong.
Right.
And hopefully, as the days go on here, if things continue to get worse, hopefully more and more businesses will realize we're just going to have to weather this and not be so salesy, because it's turning people off.
Yeah. I think I got an email from every single company that owns my email about how they were dealing with COVID-19. That's okay.
Yep.
You're just telling me, you know, you're my bank says, hey, you can't come in the lobby anymore, but we've got this ready and available for you. Here's how we'll navigate it. You know, those are okay. That's, you know, and it's given me information I can use if I need to use their service versus, hey, you should buy some jeans. I'm like, why the hell do I need jeans right now? I'm sitting around here in my underwear. I'm not going anywhere, you know? So, but I can't even cut my hair. My wife's been like hollering at me forever. She's like, I like your hair when it's long. I'm like, no, I'm cutting it. I keep it short. Now I'm like, hey, guess what, honey? You're going to see exactly what I look like with long hair now. So let's talk about how social media is helping and hurting us in the time like this. The connection, the sheer proliferation of hilarious memes has kept me alive. It's just kept me going. I love this stuff and looking for funny things to say and funny things to do. It's been a godsend. And I've had people say on my social media, they're like, Leland, thanks for the laughs or whatever. People are using social media as a way to stay connected like we've never been able to before.
Yeah. And the as you mentioned, there is good and bad. The good certainly is that, you know, it can be a distraction. It can be certainly a personal connection in a virtual, you know, world that we kind of are forced into now, where you can connect with family and friends and whatnot. Where I would push everyone a little bit, because I know not everyone is doing this, and this could certainly lead to some issues with your computer performance if everybody does this at once, but I would strongly encourage people at home to, instead of emailing or Facebooking or whatnot, do a FaceTime or a video call with your friends and your family. Check in on them with that visual, because even though we can't be in the same room with each other,
right,
that face-to-face, even virtually, makes a big difference. We've been at Cornette, where I work, we've been at home now for 2 weeks, and we collaborate on a couple of different platforms, but on all the ones that we really use the most, we do video conference calls where it's the Brady Bunch screen, where there's a bunch of us on
right.
one screen.
Right.
And just being able to look at someone else's face and their facial expressions, it doesn't solve the problem of isolation, but it certainly helps break that down a little bit and lets you feel a little less alone.
Yeah.
So the technology and the social media connections that we have can be incredibly, incredibly powerful in helping us get through this. But then, of course, we have to be a little bit more discerning about where we get our information and what we believe, because everybody is sharing everything and not all of it's good information.
Right. And that's the downside. You know, I did an Instagram live TV thing with a friend of mine from California yesterday. And we were just talking about some things, and it was really a blast. And we had a ton of people come on and watch this video. But you're right. We were talking face to face from, you know, so many miles apart. I think and a friend of mine is a pastor up in Alaska, and he called me this week and he was like, hey, he goes, I'm trying to find ways to reach my congregation when I can't gather them in the sanctuary. He's like, he was a roommate of mine in college and we've been friends ever since. He's like, hey, dude, let's do a roundtable conversation on social media, like, you know, video, where we talk about mm-hmm. life and faith. And that would be a way to sort of invite the congregation in. And so he's innovating on a technological standpoint, you know, with his church, which in the past was maybe what he thought might be too small for that innovation. Now it's become necessary. And I think that's an interesting, you know, kind of sidebar to this. It's again, to that same point, it's human connection, even if we're not in the same room. But back to the downside of it, we've got a lot of people out there who are getting partial information. Frankly, everybody has partial information about this virus, because I don't think it's possible to know everything about it. But I mean, a lot of sharing partial information, out of context information. If you go down the wrong rabbit hole on the internet or in social media, you'll come out thinking we're all going to die of Ebola. Likewise, if you go down the wrong rabbit hole, you'll come out thinking there's nothing to this and the whole thing is a conspiracy. It's kind of a balance. How do we get people to keep that balance when there's so much good in this, but also so many trap pitfalls?
Yeah, it's tough. And I, you know, when we were growing up, you know, 20 years ago or so, you would say, well, just watch the, you know, get the information from the government, because government officials are not going to mislead you. We can't say that anymore.
Right.
And that's a little scary.
Right.
And I don't necessarily have a, you know, a political dog in the hunt here. I just think we have to be really careful about where we're getting our information. And I think in a pandemic like this, where literally just going to get gas at the gas station can infect you,
right,
and can make you a carrier, even if you don't get sick, other people can get sick. I think we've got to err on the side of caution. And so I'm listening to the people who are saying, well, you have to stay home. We have to be careful. Here are the steps we have to take. And this might have to happen for a long time. This is something nobody has ever had to deal with. And at least it's alive in the earth right now, at least not on this kind of scale. And so we're going to have to figure out a new way to survive, to get through this together. But you have to be very cautious.
Right.
I think people who are like, you know what? I'm not worried about it, because they'll come up with a solution here soon. So I'm just going to go out and hang out with my friends or go to my buddy's house. Those are the exact people who are going to get sick and make the rest of us sick, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
So I'm listening to people who are trying to be very cautious and follow those guidelines. And I hope that's what reasonable people are doing.
I think, yes, I would say I would only differ in the sense that I'm also listening to people who want to reopen the country and have a plan for doing so, not necessarily like tomorrow. But I do think, you know, Colorado's governor, who's a Democrat, has instituted an economic recovery panel that he's put together, where he's basically like, we've got to be ready to emerge from the darkness. And I want to see the benchmarks in place. But to your point, I also don't think we're ready to just walk outside and go shake hands again. In fact, I may never shake anybody's hand again. I may do the air fist bump from now on. But, you know, I think you're absolutely spot on in the sense that, you know, caution is good. And you're right about you could go to the gas pump, and somebody who has it could have sneezed on their hand and held the gas pump, and then you get it. You know, I mean, it's there's precautions we have to take to these things, or else we could give it to our grandma and it could kill grandma. Maybe when this is all over, Jason, we'll think more intuitively about the flu too, right? Because the flu can do the same kind of damage, not quite as harshly, but I think we've lost 41,000 people to the flu this year since October.
Yeah.
And I used to get so mad at work when somebody would come in and they would have it. And I'm like, why would you bring that here? You know, now maybe we will social distance better during cold and flu season going forward. Once we get this behind us, maybe we'll think about how our actions when we're sick is affecting other people.
Well, I can tell you before the virus, you know, got to an epidemic pandemic state, I had a little bit of a head cold. But there were already people talking about the coronavirus and what this might do.
Right.
And so for the first time ever in my life, I was like, you know what? I feel like I could go to work today, but I shouldn't go to work today.
Right.
And so the Thursday and Friday, the week before this all went down, I worked from home. I didn't call in sick. I just worked from home. But I said, you know, I'm feeling a little, you know, sniffly, and maybe I might be contagious. So I'm just going to be more careful about it. I hope this is going to make us all understand, hey, even head colds and flu season and whatnot like that, we need to distance ourselves even better. We need to be more sanitary because we don't want to, you know, make something small become something big. And I think the education that people are having in understanding how easily this can be transmitted,
right,
is going to make everyone hopefully practice a little bit better habits when those seasons roll about. At the end, we've got to be able to take the good out of a bad situation. And I think a lot of people are going to take that as a good moving forward of, okay, I'm just going to behave differently when it's, you know, potentially, you know, communicable diseases are around me,
yeah,
to prevent those from spreading. So we can all get a lot smarter here.
Are you optimistic about an economic recovery when this gets behind us?
Well, you have to be. I hit a wall this past weekend. I was really just kind of down in the dumps on Sunday and Monday about this whole thing. But as normal with me, when I, you know, get a little, you know, melancholy about something, I dust myself off and say, no, you know, this is America. And, you know, we, you know, pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and move forward. And, you know, we have, you know, some of the greatest scientists in history are alive today, mm-hmm. working on diseases and whatnot. I have a feeling that we're going to get through this. I think the economy, I don't think we're done with this virus thing. I don't think that we need to be going back to church on Easter Sunday.
Right.
I think we're going to have to stay home for a little while longer. I think this is going to have a big economic impact, especially on retail and restaurant and hourly wage employees. And so we're going to have a hard hill to climb up after this, but we always do. Mm-hmm. We're going to get through it. We're going to figure it out. I don't have the answers right now. None of us do. But eventually, when we get back to a point where it's okay to get back out and be, you know, more, you know, socially less distant from other people, you're going to start to see the economy come back to life.
Yeah.
I love what the federal and state governments are doing now to kind of help pour a little bit of water on the forest fire
right
now.
Right.
I think that's going to help. And I'm glad we're doing that. And I'm glad for both sides of the aisle in making those decisions and doing that. But I think we may have a longer economic downturn as a result of this, because I don't see this pandemic going away in the next 30 days.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. I concur that it'll be a long hill to climb, and I concur that we'll climb it because it's what we do. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and there was this adventurer named Colin O'Brady. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but he's the first guy to cross Antarctica unassisted and unsupported, meaning he pushed or pulled a 300-pound sled across the entire continent, and he had to carry all of his supplies with him. He wasn't resupplied or rescued. And he was talking about life. He said, you know, he likes to experience life on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the greatest possible joy capacity of a human being, and 1 being the worst amount of despair. And he was like, it's impossible to experience 10s without 1s. And he said, most Americans are stuck between 4 and 6. It's easy in America, at least up till now, to get to a 4 and 6, where you're kind of safe, but you can avoid the 1s for the most part, right? And he said, right. That's where most people are stuck. And that stuck with me because I thought what we're going through now as a country is a definite 1, right? I mean, it's a definite 1. But America's always taken 1s and turned them into 10s eventually. And what I know is my grandparents' generation was known for collecting tinfoil, known for storming the Normandy. I don't want my generation to be known for fighting over toilet paper. So, you know what I mean? So what I'm hoping is that we'll get beyond that and we'll come together and we'll climb that hill, as you said. Before I let you go, people are going to need ingenuitive, inventive marketing to keep their businesses alive. You work for Cornette, an inventive and innovative advertising agency. How can people get a hold of you and your corporation for help when we come through this on the other side to try to keep their business alive and thrive?
Well, sure. I appreciate that. TeamCornette.com is our website. We're pretty easy to find down there on Main Street in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm Jason Falls everywhere. So if you want to email me, jason@jasonfalls.com, or I'm Jason Falls on all the social networks. I'm keeping up with my marketing podcast that I do on Tuesday mornings as a live stream on LinkedIn, and then I rip the audio off as a podcast. So I'm going to continue to give good marketing advice and try to stay away from getting into coronavirus stuff, but certainly help people get through how to market in a pandemic as we hit those topics. So I'm here to help, and I'm glad to. So reach out to me. I'd love to connect.
And you can also go to Amazon.com and you can buy Jason Falls, The Rebel's Guide to Email Marketing. Jason Falls, no bullshit social media. you can do that on a podcast. And you're working on another book right now, aren't you?
I am. I'm writing a book that should come out probably this time next year. I'm hoping to get it a little earlier, though, from Entrepreneur Press, called Winfluence, the Ultimate Guide to, or I'm sorry, that's not the subtitle.
He doesn't know his own title.
I don't. Winfluence. It's basically a book about influence marketing.
Love it.
And we go beyond, you know, the Instagrammers and the YouTubers. It's really talking about influence from a very larger perspective, much more large perspective. I'm working on that now. Should be out early next year.
When are they going to come to their senses and get you on for a TED Talk?
You know, part of that is my doing. You have to apply for TED Talks.
Yeah.
And I have not applied yet. I've looked into it, and there's so many people in line to do it. Like, I wouldn't be able to get one for another year.
Right.
So I'm lining up to make sure that I have one out there with this, the launch of this book, to accompany that.
Good.
So eventually I'll get up on that stage.
Good. You should, because you've got a lot to offer. You've got a unique insight, and you've got a great and hilarious way of putting things. So I would love to see that. Hey, Jason, it's great to talk to you. I'm sure we'll talk again. Thanks for your insight today.
Yeah, Leland, thanks for having me on the show, man.
All right, Jason Falls. And again, you can check out his books on Amazon.com. Super guy. Thanks to our guest, Jason Falls, for joining us. We appreciate it. It was a blast. Had a great time chatting with him. And look, folks, stay home for a little bit longer. I do agree that we need to open business back up. I'm thinking somewhere between the end of April and May 1st, we should be our target date if we have reached those benchmarks. We have more testing, and we have more hospital capacity. Thanks for listening. My co-host and co-executive producer is Cameron Mills. Thanks to our friends at Dynamics Audio Productions for their production support of the program. And you can find them at dxaudio.com. I have a fun announcement now. We are officially on iHeartRadio. So if you have the iHeartRadio app on your phone, you can get the Disruption Zone delivered every episode straight to your phone. We are now on iHeartRadio's app in the podcast section, so we're super excited about that. So now, I can honestly say wherever podcasts are found, right? You can get us on Apple Play or Apple. Yeah, it is. What is it? Apple Podcasts. You can get us on Google Play. You can get us on Spreaker, and you can get us on iHeartRadio. So make it happen. And the best thing you can do for me is to share this podcast with your friends, because every new listener amplifies our voice. And we can make this awesome and a big effect on our society and our state for positive stuff. So thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.